Good afternoon. I'm presenting accelerating parallel analysis of scientific simulation data via Zazen. This is joint work with my colleagues Charles Renneman, Patrick Miller, Federico Sacerdoti, Ron Giroux, and David Shaw at the eShell Research. What you see in the left lower corner here is the behavior of a protein called BPTI at an extremely slow motion mode. In real time, this will take a few nanoseconds. You won't be able to see anything. So computer simulations of these biomolecular systems at atomic level of detail are usually called molecular dynamic simulation, or simply MD simulation. Although many important biological processes are known to occur on the order of milliseconds, until very recently, the longest MD simulation on any supercomputer in the world has remained on the order of microseconds. So one of the goals of the eShell research is to make it possible to execute millisecond scale long MD simulations. And we have been developing a special purpose parallel supercomputer called Anton, shown in the right corner, that finished the first millisecond long simulation 8 months ago on the protein structure called BPTI. What it means by executing a millisecond long MD simulation from a data perspective. Here's a brief summary. Assume we have a biomolecular system that have 25,000 atoms, and that we're interested in recording the positions and the velocities of all the atoms. We're talking about 600 kilobyte per output snapshot we call frames. And when we run a millisecond simulation and assuming we're outputting at a 10 picosecond interval. So these are simulated physical time, not real world clock time. We're talking about 100 million frames. So imagine this, you have a long sequence of pretty small files, and that jointly constitutes what we call a trajectory of this MD simulation. So I'll first tell you how we analyze these very long MD trajectories in parallel. Here's a simple example. It's extremely simplified. What you see here is a picture that's showing a membrane protein. Here in the middle of the picture, you see this red box which highlights a channel that connects the two sides of the membrane. And this animation shows potassium ions permeate through the channel from the bottom of the membrane to the top and occasionally interleaved by water molecules. So the analysis of this simulation is to understand when and whether particular ions ever permeate through the channel from the bottom to the top or the top to the bottom, and for how long they reside in the channel. And we're not going into the details why these are biological significant events, but this is what scientists try to understand. So let's assume we have a hypothetical trajectory that has 20,000 atoms. That's everything you saw in the previous slides, 20,000 atoms. And we are interested in two particular ions, say A and B. Represented here with the yellow and the pink curves. The x-axis represents the time of the simulation, and the y-axis shows the vertical position of the ion over time. This shaded area represents the channel we're interested in understanding when these ions permeate through. For clarity of this presentation, assume this channel does not change its height over time. Now you run the simulation, and over time, you create a series of frames. In the end, you have a complete trajectory. You want to analyze it. So this slide shows if you want to analyze such data, you have to use such state transition diagram to understand what's going on. I will not go into details here, but I want to deliver a point that you cannot just come to a conclusion by looking at the positions of a particular ion at two adjacent time steps. Because you cannot tell if this ion actually permeates through the channel from the bottom by just looking at two positions. So if you analyze the data sequentially, this is how you would do it, typically. You maintain a memory resident data structure, read all the frames one by one in ascending order, retrieve the position of the ions you're interested in, update the state according to the state transition diagram I showed on the previous slide. So this all works fine, but there's a strong inter-frame dependency for this type of data analysis. You cannot proceed ahead until you have processed all the frames up to this point. The side effect is that This implies data analysis is tightly coupled with data retrieval or data acquisition. And of course, you say, so what? Now, we cannot perform very large-scale MD trajectory analysis using the sequential method because it does not have the computational memory or I/O capability to scale to very large data set. So here's a summary. If we have a 60 terabyte MD trajectory, assuming you're analyzing this on your workstation with 100 megabyte per second read bandwidth from disk, it will take about a week to read the whole data set into memory. And then the analysis time varies depending on how complex your analysis is. So we have come up with a new parallel data analysis model. The idea is first you specify which frames you want to analyze, you want to access. So we call it trajectory definition. And second, we want to decouple data acquisition from data analysis. To do that, we split the second step into two stages. In the first stage, we do per-frame data acquisition. In the second stage, we do cross-frame data acquisition, a data analysis. Going back to our example, so we have this, we know this is the final result, right? We specify we want to analyze every other frames in the trajectory, or you can specify stride size, how you want to sample this trajectory. And then in the first stage of the analysis, we do per-frame data acquisition. What it means is that we can divide the frames among two nodes, assuming we have two nodes doing parallel processing. The first node will access all the frames, half of the frames in the first half. And the second node will access the frames in the second half of the trajectory. Note that both nodes will access both the coordinates of ion A and ion B, not just a particular ion. So in the second stage, we can analyze the time series associated with ion A on one node and the time series associated with ion B on another node. Now you say, this sounds good, but how do you connect the two stages? Right? There's a jump here when it's not coherent. To do the connection, we were inspired by Google's MapReduce programming abstraction. In particular, in their programming model, you define a computation in a map phase and in a reduce phase, and the data communication pivoting is done by the runtime system. So casting trajectory analysis into the MapReduce model, we can think of the per-frame data acquisition is a map function, and the cross-frame data analysis can be implemented in a reduce function. The key or the hinge that connects the two stages of analysis are the key value pairs. In particular, we can think of keys as categorical identifier or names that specify a group of data. And for values, we record or we yield or we emit not only the position of the ions, but also the timestamp associated with the frame from which the position was extracted. So in the reduce phase, what you can do is you group all the values associated with a particular key, that's a particular ion, and sort the time sequence according to the timestamp. Then you have a complete time, you can reconstruct the time series associated with each individual ion. Now you can proceed in parallel to analyze the data. So we have implemented this methodology in a library called HiMark. It's implemented on top of MPI and Python. And the biochemists can implement their analysis programs using Python and existing analysis software. And it's also provide a parallel runtime system that will execute user jobs on a commodity Linux cluster. This is not running on Anton supercomputer I just showed on the first slide. This runs on commodity Linux clusters. And we achieve about two orders of magnitude speed up, scaling from one core to 512 cores. Now, this all sounds great. What's the problem? The problem is that, as shown in this slide, this is the typical configuration of a high-performance simulation, high-performance data analysis storage structure. What happened was a high-performance computer output the simulation data through an I/O node to file servers, and then the file servers is usually also under heavy read load from the analysis program that may be running on hundreds of analysis nodes. So it's easily a hotspot in the whole configuration, and sometimes it's a bottleneck. We have seen cases where the read workload from the analysis was so intensive, it caused the file server stop responding to write request sent by the I/O node of the parallel supercomputer. So in the second part of this talk, I would describe in somewhat detailed level how we overcome this I/O bottleneck encountered in parallel data analysis. First, let me summarize the characteristics of the kind of trajectory we deal with. And this is very specific to MD trajectories or the kind of problem we deal with. But we do believe that for a large class of time-dependent scientific simulations, they have similar characteristics. First, we have a large number of relatively small frames. This is not necessarily true for billion-element PDE simulations, but it's true for us. And these frames are write once, read many. They never change. Once you write to the disk, they stay there unless you delete it. You never go there, edit the output or the position of the ions explicitly. And also, it's evident that because this is a time-dependent simulation, you can distinguish frames from frames using unique sequence number. You can use integer number to identify a particular frame. And also, because of the MapReduce type of processing model I just described, accessing the frames are amenable to out-of-order data access. You can access them in parallel. The order is irrelevant here, as long as you access all the frames once and only once. So our main idea is to cache the simulation output it actively in the local disks of the compute of the analysis node at simulation time. And when you do the analysis, then the compute node try to fetch data from its local disk instead of from the file servers. So this is really high level. Bear with me. I will go into more details here. The limitation of this approach is, first, you have to provision a cluster with large aggregate storage capacity. Otherwise, you cannot cache very large data set, or your data set will be evicted very quickly after a simulation is completed. Second, we assume a relatively low average simulation output rate. Here, our ballpark target, the upper limit we target is 1 gigabyte per second. So that does not sound very high, but for those in the audience who work in high-performance computing or related project, if you output 1 gigabyte per second on average, you're going to fill out 1 petabyte data within 12 days. So for us, this is sufficient, but for many applications, this may or may not be true. Here's an example. This is a snapshot of the data storage and the caching, how the data distributed among the analysis node after a simulation I call SIM1. Is completed. Assume it produced only 4 frames, 0, 1, 2, 3, and we have 2 analysis nodes, 0 and 1. As these frames were generated by the simulation, the frames were placed in round-robin order on the 2 nodes. So you end up with frame 0, frame 2 on the first node, and 1 and 3 on the second node. We also explicitly record the sequence number associated with the frame that have been cached locally on these nodes. Now, at analysis time, each node will look up its local record, see what kind of frames I have already. On node 0, you see I have 0 and 2, so it constructs a bitmap with a vector size equal to the number of total frames you analyze. And based on what frames you have cached locally or what data you have, you fill out the bits in this vector accordingly. So node 1 does the same thing. Then they communicate the bitmap with each other. So on receiving the bitmap from the other node, the results are merged. Now you have a complete bitmap with all the bits set. So this is an extremely simplified explanation, just give you intuition what we try to do. In implementation, we do not do point-to-point communication or merge the bitmap explicitly on the receiving node. So you will say, this all sounds so good. I mean, it's just a simple solution. There's no trouble here. Why do we bother with trying to make it work? Nodes do fail and do recover. So at the time a node fails, from the time a node fails, all the data cached there, all the frames cached there will become unavailable. You cannot access data anymore. So these frames will be accessed and cached by other nodes while this node is down. Now assume this node comes back online again. If it's not a hard disk error or it's not file system crash, the previously cached data may well be available again. Now you have conflicts. Now, you have 2 nodes, both try to say, I'm going to access this frame. How do you resolve the conflict? Right. So this is a very simple failure recovery sequence. More sophisticated, more complex sequence can occur in practice. So to overcome this problem, we developed a distributed consensus protocol called Zazen. I will not go into the details of how the Zazen protocol works. You can find that in the paper. Here's an outline of the main idea on how we want to enforce this consistency requirement. So we want to assign the data retrieval task in a location-aware manner. If a node has the data already cached, that node should be the one that reads that piece of data. And when the assignment is done, before any actual I/O takes place, every node will run this protocol and come to a conclusion what frame it should access. They try to read the data from the local disk. If the data is not available, they fetch it from the file server. So there's no metadata involved in this whole scenario. Every node knows only what data it has cached locally. There's no Oracle out there telling everyone where to fetch what data. So to implement this protocol, we use bitmap, which is a compact representation of very large vectors of presence or non-presence of particular frames in a local cache. Right? The idea you have seen in the previous example. And we also use auto reduction algorithms to implement this communication of bitmaps among the nodes. In practice, we used OpenMPI in our implementation. So here's the implementation. It consists of three components. We have the Bode library, which is a client library that allows application programs to read and write, read from and write to the cache. And we also have a Bode server, which runs on each analysis node independently. They don't talk to each other. And on top of that, we have the Zazen protocol, which is a client library. And all the nodes before start fetching data from the Bode server will execute the Zazen protocol upfront. So the change to your normal I/O storage infrastructure is you have to push the data into the file server and the local disks of the analysis node on the I/O node of your supercomputer. It's connected, it's linked with the Bode library. So here's a very quick overview of the performance. Our experiments were conducted on a Linux cluster with 100 nodes. These are pretty standard commodity nodes with two Intel Xeon processor. We have 400-500 gigabyte SATA disks, and with all the other storage requirements of operating systems and other files, we can, the useful capacity on each node is about 1.7 to 1.8 terabyte. So altogether, we have 180 terabyte disk cache space. And all these nodes were connected through a core switch with 4 bisectional bandwidth. They all have common access to NFS that's supported by a number of high-end enterprise-level storage servers. So this is the fixed scalability of the Zazen protocol. Now, this is one component of the three components I just described, just the Zazen protocol. This slide shows how long it takes to execute the Zazen protocol to assign I/O task of 1 billion frames. The x-axis shows the number of nodes in log scale. The y-axis shows the time. So if there's only one node there, there's no communication, it takes 2 seconds. If there's a large number of nodes, the takeaway message here is it's flat. The runtime of the all-reduce algorithm does not grow with the number of nodes in the system, so it stays flat. The dip in the curve is probably because OpenMPI picked an alternative auto reduction algorithm when seeing this particular number of nodes and the vector size. This is still the scalability of the Zazen protocol. Now, it shows the execution time of the Zazen protocol on 100 nodes, but assigning different number of frames, starting from 1,000 to 1 billion. And again, it's log scale. It's sublinear, as you can see. It's below the diagonal. So to this point, we were pretty confident that this whole system would be scalable because the Bode library and the Bode client are independent components. They just run independently on each node. They don't talk to each other. Right, there's no need to communicate with any metadata server that can potentially become a bottleneck. And the Zazen protocol, this is the performance or scalability of the Zazen protocol. Now, we also look at efficiency of the whole system. This particular experiment, we tested two implementation alternatives. In the first implementation, we forked our Bode server daemon for each application process. And what we found was, if you have more than one application read process and you fork a read daemon for each of these app processes, the aggregate I/O bandwidth actually drops significantly, going from 1 to 2. And it's not so significant when you're accessing relatively small files, 2 megabyte files. And we believe this is because for large files, the file system and the storage device is much more efficient doing streaming and do bulk load. Once you have competing I/O requests in the queue, you start to somehow schedule it in the wrong way. So we improve the implementation and serialize the I/O request and only start one body server daemon on each node. So that's the net result. That means when application has two read processes, the read request will be queued internally. It's serialized. At every instance, there's only one read request sent by the server daemon to the storage layer. So we also compare the performance of Zazen, overall performance of Zazen with NFS and other parallel file system. NFS runs on separate enterprise storage level storage servers. PVFS 2 and Hadoop HDFS both run on the same 100 nodes configuration. And believe me, we tried our best to try to optimize the performance of PVFS 2 and the Hadoop HDFS. So for details, you have to read the paper. So here's the outline of the performance result. When reading 1 terabyte of 2 megabyte files, 2 megabyte frames, each group shows the performance of the read bandwidth from these 4 file systems, NFS, PVFS2, HDFS, and Zazen. Zazen consistently very well performing because this is a tailored cache system. It's supposed to, but it's not a general purpose file system. And Hadoop performs pretty good, above 5 gigabytes per second. For some reason dropped to 1 gigabyte per second, below 5 gigabyte per second when it accesses 1 gigabyte files. Surprisingly, Hadoop cannot deal with very large number of files, which was later validated by the Hadoop community. It has trouble dealing with a large number of small files. So this is equivalent to representation of the previous slides, but we changed the y-axis to time. So this shows how long it would take to read 1 terabyte data of different sizes. So the yellow curve still correspond to the Zazen performance. It can read reasonable, let's say 50 seconds, it can read 1 terabyte of data of reasonably large files. So this slide shows the performance of the Zazen read, the read performance of Zazen under write workload. We're assuming an aggregate 1 gigabyte per second write load onto the Zazen cluster, pushing data into the cache. And each group shows the read performance of Zazen of reading different files from 2 megabyte or to 1 gigabyte. Within each group, the first bar shows the performance of the read performance without any writes. The second one shows the performance of writes while the writers were pushing 1 gigabyte files into the cache. So generally, it performs reasonably well. The worst degradation of performance, the worst degradation of the read performance is about 20%. In the most demanding case, when you're pushing 2 megabyte small files and they're reading very large files. So this shows the end-to-end performance of the Zazen protocol implemented and installed in practice when we analyze data. The yellow curve, the green curve shows the time of executing this analysis, assuming all the data were already cached in main memory. And the yellow curve shows the Zazen performance. And the red curve shows NFS. That's reading data, doing the map, and the reduce. So this is the same program re-executed while we turn off different number of nodes in the cluster, ranging from 0 to 50% of nodes. We actually turn off 50 nodes. And the red curve shows the theoretical worst case. The yellow curve shows what we obtained, we measured in practice. To summarize, first of all, this Zazen system has been in production for about 10 months at DeShaw Research. And our goal is to accelerate all the independent data access by these MapReduce type of analysis jobs. And the whole protocol, as you see, is rather straightforward and robust. And it can scale to a large number of nodes. Because the size of our analysis cluster, I couldn't show further data illustrating scalability. But practically, as long as MPI is scalable, this protocol is scalable. And also, we achieve much higher read bandwidth than NFS and PVFS with a huge caveat. This is intended to be a cache to accelerate the read performance. It cannot replace the backend file systems. Without a reliable though consistently slow NFS server in the backend, Zazen cannot deal with cache misses. What if the data were not there, cannot deal with it? And lastly, this technology, this technique is applicable to, we believe, a certain class of time-dependent simulation data analysis. And beyond that, for general purpose applications, if you could cast your data set in some total ordering in either the temporal or spatial domain, you can distinguish your data in some kind of integer sequence number, we believe Zazen can also be used to accelerate the data access. Thank you very much. I have some time to take questions.
Ask a question. So it seems like what you're suggesting here actually might be useful for other systems that want to do this kind of thing. Like, could you apply these caching techniques in HDFS? Do you think that would be a benefit? And how much work would that take?
It's a very different system architecture from HDFS, where you have one single metadata server to keep track of all the data. And the performance degradation of HDFS was caused by two effects. One was the HDFS server, metadata server, couldn't keep up with the memory requirements of so many small files. The second was the Hadoop runtime. The job controller couldn't keep track of so many outstanding jobs. So in some sense, it's an orthogonal design choice to HDFS, because we don't have a centralized metadata server to take care of the I/O, to coordinate the I/O.
Thank you. Thank the speaker again.